Session number 12537, Herbert Broster, Reel 2.
Mr. Broster, Reel 2. I think you were explaining that the Morse training...
Yes, I think the people who turned out on the course on the wireless section that turned out quite brilliant were the ones that were segregated and sent on to more specialised wireless or signal units.
So they were keeping an eye on you as you were training?
Oh, yes, very much so. So you had a class, so you were given a group number, the group 1, group 2, or group 3, depending on how good you were. I made the group 3, and I was passable, but average as a wireless operator. But bearing in mind I'd never had any connection with wirelesses before, I was fairly satisfied with that.
Did you see anything of officers while you were undergoing this basic training?
Yes, I suppose in the single training regiment, they more or less took the form of headmasters, if you like, in a school, public school possibly, and wandering around the classrooms and seeing how the instructors, because most of the instructors were sergeants, and seeing how they were getting on and asking one or two, a pep talk here and there. And then the only other time you really saw them was when it came to whoever was orderly officer, when you were on mounting guard in the evening or during the night when the orderly officer came round, you know, checking patrols and time. But there was very little problem from officers at all in training regiments. And that also applied when we went to Cromer. The officers did their proper jobs, i.e. the battery commander with the guns and the troop commanders and the wireless OP officer, who was normally a captain. And yes, they all did their jobs, but they were working officers, very much a working part of that unit. And they treated us with the greatest respect.
What about at Colchester? Did you see any officers there?
You only saw them in Colchester when you fell in on the parade ground at 7:30 in the morning or whatever it was, and the troop sergeant, first of all, or company sergeant, they were there, took the parade, then the roll call was called, and he passed it to the sergeant major, and he, a company sergeant major, and then he in turn passed it to the captain or major who was taking the parade first thing in the morning. And yes, there was always one of them in attendance, even on the ranges. He was not normally the bullying type that the NCO you would expect to be. And I think, to be fair, when on reflection of this bullying at Colchester, I think it was because most of them did it because it was expected of them. They had to produce results. But there was no physical thing, it was just...
Just psychological.
Yeah.
When you were doing your shooting at Colchester, did you fire a full course of musketry?
Oh, yes.
What sort of ranges were you shooting at?
They vary. It started off on the short with the 2.2 rifle in the first one, at up to 100 yards, and then you went on to the full ranges, 200, 300, 500 yards. They were full-size ranges there. You know, I can't remember the longest range we fired at, but they were certainly the full ranges that you would expect to find on Salisbury Plain today and that type of thing.
Do you know how many rounds you fired during your course of musketry?
I would say in the total course in that 6 weeks, I must have fired somewhere in the region of 400 rounds on rifles. There were machine guns as well, which is very difficult to assess how many you did fire.
Did you have a prior knowledge of firearms? Had you been familiar? Were you already familiar with firearms?
Yes. Well, I had the 303 Lanfield in the Home Guard, and we did a certain amount of firing. In fact, we used to use the ranges at the Royal Military College for that in those days, as it was called. And so, yes, I had fired quite a bit. Although the Lee Enfield that we used in the Army was a more modern weapon than the one that was issued to the Home Guard.
So, in effect, quite a lot of your basic training was going over the same ground again, under more pressure.
That's right, yeah. Advanced, if you're slightly advanced.
And when you were at Cromer, you say you were doing live firing and so on. I presume this must have made the training quite hazardous.
Yes, there were certainly many casualties, and in fact I heard a figure bandied around that they allowed for 5% casualties in that type of training, because with the best will in the world, you could always put a battery of fire down in the wrong position on a map reading, because it was all done on map readings, you see.
So it's all indirect.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the OP would be the one. Usually could see it visibly, the target. In the first part of live training, or live firing at Cromer, was mainly 8C in the first 2 or 3 weeks to hulks of old ships that had been torpedoed or whatever and laying on the sands. I don't know if you know the Norfolk coast, but it's long stretches of sand, you know. And there were 2 or 3 laying about there and used to fire on these, which it meant you could visibly see what you were aiming at. And from the gunner's point of view, psychologically, I think it was quite good because 9 times out of 10 in actual battle conditions, if you like, on open land, the gunner never sees what he's firing at. It was only people like us in the observation point that could see that.
And what did you do then? Did you actually go out and observe the fall of shots?
Yes, we used to go ahead, establish an OP, and it used to be on a slight brow or somewhere, you know, so you could look down over the target area. And then the OP officer and his assistant was usually a bombardier, sometimes a lance sergeant, would have their maps out and decide where it was and call out the coordinates. By that time we'd have the radio going, and we used to always have to set up a telephone communication as well as the radio to fall back on. Although we found 9 cases out of 10, if anything was going to fail, it was the telephone, because somebody had tripped over the wire somewhere, you know, or cut it. And they used to do this on these live exercises. Somebody would infiltrate the area and literally cut the telephone wires purposely. And then you had the job of going along the wire, finding it and repairing it. And, you know, that was a full-time job almost.
Splicing the wires.
Splicing the wires, yeah. It was quite easy once you found the break. But, they used to do that. And I suppose the most terrifying thing, when they were putting down what they called a ladder range, and this was up 50, up 50, and they would start fairly close in front of you, of the OP point. And these 25 pounders whistling over your head, believe me, you know, you really do duck. You can hear them coming. And it, and then when they whine over there, and you watch them explode, and you instinctively duck your head behind whatever you can, because they can be less than 100 yards in front of you. And if it happens to be AP shells, which are splinters, flying all over the place, you know, and I've known them go through the bushes over top of us many times, but never had any casualties, fortunately. But you learn to keep your head down, and bear in mind this was training as well, with students, if you like. So more so, I think you were a bit wary as to whether you could trust them fully. But it was good fun. Yeah.
Sounds like it was the noise that was really the frightening.
Yeah, the noise of a shell going over your head in an OP point is quite frightening. Once you've got used to it, you can tell how close it's going to go in front of you. Even great knowing, looking over the OP officer's head to look at his map, because you're all pretty close there, and, you know, we knew exactly what he was doing once you got used to it, and we used to watch over his shoulder, and in fact, once or twice we butted in different places and said, I don't think that's right, you know.
how did the officer respond when you did things?
Oh,
like
they were okay, because as an OP group, there were 4 of you, and nobody ever said, sir. You know, it was just turn around to each other, and because you mess in and you used to have to cook your meals and everything there, you know, okay, it was pretty basic, and a tin with holes in it, and earth and petrol mix, you know, to make a fire and stick the can on the top, and whoever was doing least would cook the meal, whether it was the officer or one of the wireless operators. But that happened all the way through. You never had, once you got out there, okay, he, even in the final analysis, was in charge, but there was never any question of yes, sir, no, sir. He would just say, he would use your Christian name in most cases.
Yeah. Was the officer usually a lieutenant or second lieutenant?
Usually, when it came to the more advanced units, it was always a captain. But under training, in many cases, they were lieutenants. Yeah, obviously waiting on promotion.
Were they also undergoing a certain degree of training then?
Mm. Because most of them had come from OCTUs, you see.
So you were training as a team?
Mm. Oh, yeah. Very much so.
Do you remember who your lieutenant was at Cromer?
No, because we had a lot of different ones, and they were all trainees, you know, or most of them were. I can't even remember who the battery commander's name was there. We were only there 6 weeks, and, you know, it was 50-odd years ago.
You mentioned doing ladder shoots where you'd be lifting up 50. Do you remember doing things like time concentrations or other?
Yeah, we did battery concentrations and regimental fires occasionally, where you had a number one gun ranging, and he would range on that target, and all the rest would be brought in on that gun. And believe me, that's impressive, especially when you've got a full battery, a full regiment of 24 guns, all coming down on one target. And even in those days, in spite of all the technology today, it was amazing how close they would group that 24. Mm. The only time you would get it fall short, sometimes if the powder was wrong in the actual explosive, you know, and this can happen in time of war, but generally speaking, the 25 pounder was a very accurate gun. And you would reckon the 24 guns to drop them all within, well, certainly within 50 yards.
So it's only
it would obliterate anything, you know.
Defects in propellant, then.
That's right. That was the biggest risk for the OP point of view. If you did have a defect and it came down in your OP point, well, or if it came down near, you ducked. And it did happen occasionally. It came down pretty close.
Did they ever subject you to simulated counter-battery fire?
No, we were never put at the sharp end of anything at all. The only time, you know, obviously in training, you went through the gas chamber, that type of thing, you know, but not putting you down, because I think they considered, from the OP point of view, you were close enough to it in any case. You saw the after effects, and you saw it happen pretty close. But there's a lot of difference, though, with a different type of ammunition. Like, you had the ordinary HE explosive, and then you had the anti-personnel shell, which explodes 2 feet above the ground and throws it everywhere. And then you had the air burst, as they called it, which burst higher up altogether. And that really was for action theoretically against infantry, so that it sprayed it over a wide area. And a pretty lethal weapon even then.
Do you remember ever cooperating with armour on these exercises at Cromer?
Yes, at Cromer there was armour used, but let me put it this way, this was a little bit before the time of the heavy armour on tanks, and they were mostly Churchills armed with two-pounders and things like that. With Bren gun carriers, yes, there was a lot of them, but they were only armed with Lewis machine guns and that type of thing. But the tanks weren't what I would call used to great effect. And this rather surprised me in the Norfolk area, because it's very, very flat. Although the one of the hazards to it also is a lot of water. And they could get bogged down pretty easy. And that may have been one of the reasons why there weren't many about.
A lot of wet clay.
A lot of wet. Well, because you've got all the broads around there as well, you see. And I should say the water table in Norfolk must be pretty high. And you get a Churchill, for instance, and the weight that is, it would take long to go through it.
What about your wireless truck? That must have been heavy vehicle.
No, they weren't really. They were the equivalent of what we would call a 1500 weight truck today. You know, although the ones we were using were rather superior. They were Humber Snipes, a long bonnet, more like a conversion from a high-powered 1939 car, if you like. They were super things, six-cylinder engines and everything, and they really would motor. Rather expensive, I would have thought, but I suppose it was quicker to convert them or use them from the production line rather than going over to another.
Was this then like a sort of estate car?
No, it was like an ordinary 1500-weight truck with canvas tilt at the back, but it was lower, much lower, because it had smaller blown tyres than the ordinary 1500-weight Ford that you see in the Army today. And even those that we found in the Army during the war, because we had the 1508 Ford and the Bedford, the Fordson, the Chevrolet, they were all, you know, the basic truck on the high tyres. But these were much, much lower, and you got the impression riding in them, especially the spring, that you were really riding in a staff car, even if you were in the back.
What were they like cross country?
Quite good. They were quite good, providing you kept the knack was to keep your toe down, because once they started spinning, they would. Because they didn't have the heavy tread tyre like the normal conventional army truck. They had more like a civilian tyre. But they were quite good in fields and everything, because there wasn't a lot of weight in them, you see. You had four people plus the wireless, or two wirelesses possibly, and the batteries, and your own kit. Well, that certainly didn't come up to 1500 weight. So they were okay there, but they were extremely fast on the roads. Extremely fast.
What sort of speed could you get out of it then on a road?
On a road, we didn't obviously go to their top speeds, but there was no problem whatever getting 70 mile an hour out of them. None whatever.
Was it reliable?
Oh, yes, very reliable, yeah. Yeah. For road work, as I say, cross country, I think they would soon have come to a stop when you got really rough ground, because the clearance underneath was not much more than a car. And you'd have had your sump busted or your differential or something like that.
Did you have to do the maintenance on it then?
No. These were handed back to the fitter shop. The reason for that was that the two drivers on there were primarily wireless operators. You see, this wasn't an active service unit, it was a training unit, and they were maintained by the garage itself.
But presumably you've done training in
this. Oh, yeah. When you got to a unit abroad, you did your own maintenance there, although you had a REMI LAD unit attached to the regiment to do the major repairs and the major servicing, but you were responsible abroad for this ordinary servicing of your truck all the time, especially in the field.
So ordinary servicing would entail things like oil changes?
Just check it, fuel lines, which probably was the cause of most breakdowns in the army, allowing every Tom, Dick and Harry to mess about with fuel lines, and the olives would go and the threads would go, you know, because there's nothing softer than the brass on a thread, or it was brass in those days. And I think it was probably one of the biggest mistakes the army ever made by forcing drivers to do this sort of thing.
Where did you go then after Cromer?
Yes, we went on, we were on draft then, we were called, and we went to the 95th Anti-Tank Regiment at back to North Wales again, actually, at Conway, just beyond Conway Castle on the beach. And it was rather strange going there. There were 40 of us. And when we got there, the unit comprised of totally all small men, because the anti-tank guns that they had at that time were only 2 and 6 pounders, quite small. And I suppose they use a common sense. They put short chaps in the anti-tank regiment, and it looked so odd. When we were on parade in the morning, there were 40 of us standing there, all sort of 5'6" to 6'5", and these chaps all on average 6 inches short. It was rather strange, but we didn't do any duties there whatsoever. We didn't do any training. We were there a week, and we were sent home on 7 days embarkation leave. That's all we got. And then we were told to report back there. Well, as soon as we got back there, we started going through a process of inoculations for yellow fever, tetanus, TAB, all these type of things, and vaccinations. And then we were issued with khaki drill. And we hadn't been told where we were going. Of course, khaki drill gave you a very good indication that it was somewhere in the east. And so then suddenly we were told that we were sailing 2 days later. Didn't say where from or anything, just sailing 2 days later, confined to camp 48 hours. So there was no warning, you know, for anybody to go out and say goodbye to their girlfriends or whatever. You were just confined to camp. So, anyway, a little bit of a do in the canteen that evening, you know. And then we were put in trucks, taken down the station on the morning that we were leaving, about 10 o'clock. And we went into Liverpool and to Prince's Landing Stage, and there was this troop ship standing laying there, among many others. There were 8 or 9 of them around the docks. You could see quite all painted grey. And anyway, it turned out that this one was the next Royal Mail liner, the Alcantara. And we boarded it, and I could recall walking up the gangplank, and the duty people on board, they used to have regular soldiers on board, so a permanent staff of soldiers or whatever, and this one was manned by the RAF. Not the crew, but the duty people for the services. Yeah, and there were two of them standing at the top of the gangplank, two corporals, RAF corporals, they were probably 40 years of age. And I can recall one of them saying to the other one, "Christ, Jack, we're going to lose this war." He said, "They're sending bloody schoolboys out." That was the very words he used, you know. And I thought, insult, you know. I was quite upset with this. I didn't say anything. Well, you didn't answer back, you know. And anyway, we got on this boat, and there were 4,000 of us on there in the end when she sailed. And we sailed out of the Mersey that evening. And very difficult to work out where you were going, but we certainly went round the north of Ireland. You could get that by watching the sun and that sort of thing, you know. And, then next morning, in daylight, we'd formed up with a tremendous convoy. There were ships as far as you could see. And then, of course, immediately, as soon as we'd had breakfast, there was boat drill and there was all the other sorts of drills going on, you know. And there was air raid alarms, all sorts, all manner of things. And I think the first day out, we had three submarine alerts. As it happened, nothing transpired from any of them. But this went on for 4 or 5 days. And then one night, I said, we're near land. And somebody said, why? I said, I could smell it. You smell that. And you could smell what smelt like tarred rope. Anyhow, it turned out we were going through the Straits of Gibraltar. And we didn't touch land at all, but you could see it almost all the time on the right-hand side, the North African coast, way over in the haze, you know. And we docked at Alexandria in Egypt. Well, we docked at 9 o'clock in the morning, and we didn't get off the boat until 8 o'clock in the evening, I suppose. And along on the dockside at Alexandria were long rows of metal cattle wagons, you could call them, good trucks, you know, and sliding doors. And we embarked into these trucks. Rations were put in, haversack rations and Dixies of tea and that sort of thing. And off we went about midnight, I suppose, we left
there.
Did
you know where you were?
No. Well, we knew we were in Egypt then, because a lot of the regulars were. They knew Egypt, you know, and they recognised it. And they said, oh, we're in Alex. And that was the way.
But you hadn't been told officially?
No, hadn't been told, no, not at all. Anyhow, we left there about midnight. And by dawn, we were still chugging away across the desert. And about 9 o'clock, it must have been, we pulled up, came to a stop at what I can only call a crossroads of the rails. They were like that. And there was a couple of two or three little huts there, and then we worked out from it that it was a place called Tantar, T-A-N-T-A. And it was a railway junction for the Suez-Cairo line and the Alexandria-Cairo line, you see. So we stopped there, and, you know, and as it happens in Egypt, from somewhere materialised these boys with buckets with ice in and bottles of Coca-Cola, and they all jumped on board trying to sell it. Well, of course, nobody had any potatoes, so they took sterling, and they didn't worry what they took. You know. And that was our first induction with the Egyptians. Anyhow, we arrived at Suez at 3 or 3.30 in the afternoon. And we didn't go into the town, because the station in Suez is right in the middle of the main street. We stopped about 2 miles out, and it was tents everywhere. Army tents, long lines of them. And this was the 157 transit camp. So we stopped there, and between us and the camp was the main Cairo-Suez road, to the tarmac. And we told to fall in, and we marched across this road, and we fell in the control camp. There was a control camp, and then there were four camps, A, B, C, and D. And we were allocated C camp. And the CO, though, he's from the camp, not our own CO, but he said, you are now in the 157 transit camp at Suez. You will have a comparatively easy time here, but I regret to tell you that within 3 days, one in three of you will be over there. And he pointed across the road over the railway to a large tented area, which turned out to be the 87th General Hospital. And so everybody looked, and he said, dysentery. It's as simple as that. We can't help it. So we thought, oh, charming. Anyhow, we picked up our kit and we marched up to these tents, and we were allocated the big square tents. You know, there were six in each tent. And it didn't take long the next day to work out why the dysentery was so rampant. The dining tents were two of these tents side by side, but separated by a small walkway, if you like, and in between the middle of the walkway was a gauze frame, a gauze covered door, and it had a cord on it with a weight on the end, so you walk through the door and it slammed shut. It couldn't stay open. The idea is you walked into this walkway and the door slammed shut to keep the flies out, then you went on into the tent. Well, the first morning I walked into it, this happened, and I sat down at a 6-foot trestle table, and there's a 7-pound tin of Ass's jam on the table, which really is encouraging the flies. And as I sat down, the flies went boom, and they came out by the hundreds. Well, that is self-explanatory. And then when you saw the cooking arrangements, they were like the old-fashioned black coppers that we used to get with a fire underneath. You know, you can probably remember your mother talking about these, and a chimney at the back. And it was a mixture of oil and water that they were burning. And there were masses of black soot flakes coming out of the chimneys at the back. And if they opened the boiler when they were cooking the MNV or whatever it was, so it sailed down in there, and the rest of it went over the tents. It was really pretty obvious. They'd made tremendous efforts from the sanitary point of view not to get any problems, because you had to walk possibly 200 yards across the desert to the toilets, and they were long wooden framed galvanized covered ablutions and that, and you walked in and there was a long, long bench where you sat, and you lifted up a trapdoor and sat over the hole and did what you had to do. And out at the back there were chimneys coming out of the sand where they used to pour quicklime down and paver and set light to them every morning at 9 o'clock. It was your bad luck if you happened to be sitting on the inside when they set light to it. The smoke and everything else came oozing up there. But if you went down there at night and you sat at it, you were forced to go there. You didn't go down if you could help, because there was no lights down there, you see. You just made your own way across there. And you sat down and you could hear scuttling of these big beetles up and down the board, you know, this long platform. And they were, believe me, they were big. You know our May beetles?
Yes.
They were bigger than those. And, you know, I had the whole bit. One of those pinch you, you know all about it. But when you did hear them, you either made a noise or you got up as quick as you could. But it was basic. But I think, to be honest, that part of it worked. But you had a number of problems there. There was a court-martial offence to lose your rifle or your paybook, and you had to keep your rifles in your tent. They weren't put in an armoury. There wasn't any armoury. There were no permanent buildings. And so the idea was that you slept, your grain sheet was on the sand and you had your bedding there. It wasn't a bed roll. There was no bed rolls, you just had blankets. And you had to tuck your rifle inside the blankets with you. And of course, these Arabs were notorious for coming along outside and the hand underneath the canvas and just feeling for something, you see. And I have known of several of them who actually, because our pay books, we used to carry around our necks on a string, a bit like you did your identity discs. And I've known a chap wake up in the morning and find his pay book had gone, and he didn't know it. They'd snip the string and away. And there were rifles went as well, because the rifles were in tremendous demand up in Palestine at that time, you see, and as it was called then. So anyhow...
Did you lose anything?
No, I didn't lose anything. I was there, 2 weeks, and I did as he said, went across the 87 General with dysentery, and...
What sort of treatment did they
give? It's pretty awful. Well, first of all, you're put on a very, very strict diet, and it was literally liquid. You weren't given anything to eat at all for a week, and they kept pouring into you twice or three times a day a glass containing a white chalky substance. And I was had it explained to me later that basically dysentery is where your stomach walls are perforated and it lets the blood in. Well, the idea is it acts like cement and it seals the stomach walls. And this went on for two and a half weeks possibly, and then they had to do an examination, and they did this by getting you up on the bench on your hands and knees and your nightshirt up and an enema put into you, and believe me, it was a lot of it, and you were told to walk very carefully outside the tent and sit down on a bench until you were called in, and you'd sit out there for or half an hour, I think it was, and one or two would suddenly jump up and they'd lose the load. I was fortunate, I didn't, but there was this Palestinian nurse came out, and they'd used a lot of Palestinians on the nursing staff there, and she was a big girl, and she said, I can see her, and she said, get rid of it. I said, okay, and I just walked 6 feet away, and I just spread my legs, and away I came. There was no effort, whatever, you know. Anyway, I went in and got back up on the bench, hands and knees, and the doctor came along with, I suppose, I don't know, it was more like a telescope type thing. Well, I don't think they can use them today, with like a large bulb on the end. It was fairly long, and a couple of trigger things, and a button that he pressed, and it apparently had a battery in it, it was electric, you see. And he'd get this right up inside you, and he would check to see if there was any more blood coming.
Speculum, they call
yeah.
it.
Well, yes, I believe that is the name. Anyhow, I was clear, and I had to wait there another few days, and they put me on boiled chicken and boiled fish.
How long did it take you then to get over the dysentery?
Ah, well, I was in the hospital 3 weeks, and then I'd lost 2 stone in that time, and when I went in there, I was 10 stone 4, so you can see I'd come down quite considerably. And I didn't really put all my weight back on for over 6 months, but you were on light duties in the transit camp. There were no duties at all, just a roll call every morning, you know, and you laid there and read a book or whatever.